Welcome, and thank you for tuning in with the Open Center here and now. This is a talk with Barbara Kareles, an author, artist, innovator, instigator, and thought leader in the fields of sex, gender, and spirit. She's the author of Urban Tantra, Sacred Sex for the 21st Century, Ecstasy is Necessary, A Practical Guide to Sex, Relationships and Oh So Much More, and Luxurious Living, Tantric Inspirations for Passion and Pleasure. My name is Timothy, and this conversation will be led by the Open Center's Director of Programming, Inoai Araceli Brown. Thank you.
I was saying to you a little while ago that I see you as a very successful woman on many levels. You're a compassionate person, you're an inclusive person, but how do you see empowerment for yourself? When did that happen? How did that happen? And how do you see empowerment for other people? What exactly does that mean? Or women, really, what does that mean? Because that's important for me to know and hear from other women.
That's a great question. And hi, it's a pleasure to be here and talking to you like, you know, about something other than programming and scheduling. It's a great question. As you were asking it, I was thinking to myself, going back to like childhood, my first answer to your question was, how do you get empowered? And my first answer was fight like hell against what they're telling you you can't do. I remember my high school yearbook. That was the quote: the greatest thrill in life is doing what people say you cannot do. And my mother was actually instrumental in making me, I think, a fighter, because she suffered from emotional problems, and she had what was later termed borderline personality disorder, and it kind of manifested in a reclusive kind of intensity. And so she was afraid of everything in the outside world, and my fearlessness terrified her. But for everything she said I couldn't do, I wanted to do it 10 times more. And the downside of this is that as a teenager, I was the most accomplished liar I knew, because that's how I got to do the things that I needed to do. And what I needed to do growing up, and I first said that I wanted to do this when I was four, was I wanted to be in the theater. I wanted to be in the Broadway theater, or just theater or movies or acting in general. It got narrowed down by the time I was like 13 or 14 into theater. And when I was 16, I made a movie in my hometown of Newport, Rhode Island, and as an extra. And the director had a nervous breakdown in the course of the film, which slowed things down a lot. So I really got a taste of what movie waiting was about. Talk about the home of hurry up and wait. And I went, no, I move much too quickly for this. I can't do this. And I went, now the theater is much more conducive to the way I work. It's more of a sustained, intense process as opposed to stop, start. So, and there was the live element, which it turned out, that's the part that feels like being, other people feel like being in church, is being able to hear an audience breathe. So anyway, back when I wanted to be in the theater, it was, it still is, I suppose, but I remember this actor friend of mine saying to my mother, I understand your hesitation about her going into the theater. It's a really hard profession for women. And I'm like, thanks a lot, buddy. Now she's going to be even more scared about it, which she was. But that's how it was perceived. It was a really tough place for women. And now with everything that's been coming out about Me Too, about what has gone on in the mm-hmm. entertainment world in the past, we can see what they meant by that. Mm. But because it's just kind of the things you did to get where you wanted to be, many of the women in my generation, we're annoying to the younger women in the Me Too movement because we just went, oh, yeah, well, yeah, well, we just, that's what we did. That's what we had to do to get where we wanted to be. And so there are things that I'm really pleased that the more sensitive young women who are standing up and saying, no, we do not have to go through those things to get where we want to be.
Yeah.
I will probably never lose the armor or the shell that made some of that okay with me. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I don't need to. But everybody up coming up behind me, it would be nice if they could. If they could be less guarded or less in less anticipation of disrespect or harassment. I was lucky. I got an apprenticeship on Broadway when I was 20, I believe.
Wow.
And my boss was a strong Broadway general manager who was a woman. So that was my mentor. I have been blessed with a series of really supportive, fight like a lion for her cubs, mentor, substitute parents. Really, really, really lucky. I had one when I was 15. I had another one when I was 18. I had another one, I don't know, 35. And they were extraordinary women who helped me get to the next level, who held me to really high accountable standards.
Without traumatizing.
Thank you. Exactly. And my mother helped me kick me out the door, but there was a lot of trauma involved. Everybody else was I guess they just had their own traumas a little more under control than my mom did, my biological mom. Mm-hmm. But my last major mentor and also my closest family member for the past 30 years was Louise Hay.
Oh.
We were family to each other. We met during the AIDS crisis in New York in the 80s.
Yeah.
And then I went to take her teacher training program, and that's where we became close. And then got closer. And no matter how weird or wacky the thing was that I wanted to do or achieve, Louise was like, yeah, go for it. That sounds wild. Try it. And it made all the difference in the world, because it's like I didn't care what anyone else thought. Well, I seldom did anyway. But it was easy not to care about what other people thought when Louise Hay was standing there going, yeah, girl, go for it.
It's quite a support system there.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. It really was. So,
So standing on the shoulders of, you're saying, of strong women.
Yeah, I was standing on a lot of shoulders. My Urban Tantra Professional Training Program, which will resume, I think, in September of 2021, is where I get to pass it on, where I get to support people working with sexuality and spirituality and consciousness and healing in their own unique, weird, queer ways, and say, yeah, you go. You go, you make that happen. Because as a, cisgendered white woman of a certain age, there are a lot of places I shouldn't be.
Like?
There are a lot of, I shouldn't be advising women in Nairobi. You know, that's inappropriate.
Oh, I know. I saw that you went to Kenya once to meet the Maasai.
I love Africa. I'm absolutely passionate about Africa. So in my professional training program, I can welcome, for the sake of this example, African women, women of color, and say, what does your community need? Take the time in this program to figure that out and what your contribution can be to that community and how then can I support you? Because I don't know, I did not grow up as one of my graduates, a young queer woman in the rural American South. I have no clue how to support that community. And I shouldn't be the one talking to them. You should. What can I do to help you do it? So that's kind of where I am now around mentorship.
Nice. Empowering others. And thank you for highlighting the importance of mentorship.
Yeah, and who comes before us?
Mm-hmm. You know, I have never had an ounce of interest in things like Ancestry.com. I signed up for 23andMe
because I'm thinking about
I wanted
it.
The genetic information, and which was fabulous, by the way. But, I was getting these emails, so-and-so has X number of DNA strands connected to you and wants to know if you want to be friends. No, no, not really. I don't care where my blood family came from. I have no desire to visit the Azores of Portugal, where they all came from. I'd much rather go back to Africa. But I am passionate about the heritages I stand on artistically and metaphysically and community-wise, the queer ancestors whose shoulders I stand on, the women whose shoulders I stand on, the marginalized people whose shoulders I stand on. That's the community that I hold really, really sacred and really dear. And my activism comes purely out of that, I'm not a political person, so to speak. I couldn't probably hold a very intelligent political discussion with you for very long. But my passion is for making lives more ecstatic, really, not just a little easier, but more ecstatic and passionate for people who have been consistently kicked under the bus.
Yeah. I mean, you don't seem like a person who's afraid. You come across as friendly and open. And to me, that is an example of an empowered woman, because you're able to go up to them and speak to them and not feel like they're going to judge you, which is really you. That's how I see you.
Thank you. I do sometimes not worry about being judged, because judgments are other people's opinions. But, I do consistently ask the question, and I think we all do, where am I welcome? And on what terms? An example is this is a funny example. I went to, now that they're doing virtual services, church services.
Okay, yeah.
I was raised Catholic, or at least they tried. And I sort of basically identify as loosely as a pansexual pagan, I suppose, if forced to pick words. But I am very drawn to Black Baptist church services. I love them. Like the First Corinthian Baptist Church in Harlem. And white people are, it's one of the tourist churches. White people can go and sit upstairs. And I felt so honored when they let me sit downstairs, because I live in the neighborhood. I live in East Harlem. And I realized their services were online. Because what I feel guilty about when I go to Black church is that they're going to assume I'm Christian and I'm not. But the services, what they speak about, are absolute, and how the message is delivered with gospel, I call it gospel chanting, because it's that repetition that takes you into a trance. And this amazing speaker comes out and says, look, I know this is hard to fill in the this, but this is how we overcome it. And I leave those services feeling like my DNA has been rearranged. And I'm so grateful that the services are online, because I feel a little embarrassed, or I wonder if I belong here when I go in person. And it's not the people, the church members, they're like all about, oh, come in. And I'm like, yeah, but if you knew who I really was, you wouldn't say that. So I think we all wonder where we fit in. And mm-hmm. whether we'll be welcomed or judged. Mm-hmm. And so I just try to create as many spaces as I possibly can where that won't happen.
Okay.
You know, I try to be like the members of the First Corinthian Baptist Church who welcome me with open arms, whether it's virtually or whether I go in person. And they don't really care as long as I'm there to worship with them.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah.
But I like to think I'm thrilled with the Open Center's online programming these days, because we're able to reach people who also feel like they wouldn't fit in. I'm noticing that the people who come to my online classes, never mind the people who can now join us from Australia and from Europe and other places, but I've always had the most diverse crowd at the Open Center. It's one of the reasons I adore teaching there. And it just gets more and more diverse in terms of both race, age, background, sexual orientation, sexual preferences, all sorts of stuff, economic range. But now people who might be too shy to come in person to like a live class,
oh, yes,
are showing up because they can turn their camera off.
That's right. Good point.
Or they can move away from their camera. And they can be braver. Mm-hmm. They know that if they thought they were going to be judged, they get real quickly that can't even happen on this platform. And so that feels really good. And I'm hopeful that when we come out of lockdown, those same people who got introduced to our work at the Open Center virtually will be like, you know, and because my dream for the Open Center is that there can be Open Center outreach programs now in more places than just New York City.
Yeah.
And people will show up live. Mm-hmm. And form other communities of strong, empowered people. And yes, what is the female to male ratio of people who take Open Center courses? I would think it skews female. Well,
women, I mean, basically it's like 80% as far as I know. It's a holistic center. So
yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's 80%. That 80% are women that we are empowering. And by the way, they often, I call it the drag factor. They drag their male partners along.
I hear this a lot.
Yeah. When I go around a circle and say, so why are you here? And then I say, and if you were dragged here by your partner, you can say that it's totally cool. And then all the people who were dragged volunteer. So that's what happened. I don't know why I'm here, but it sounded interesting and she dragged me here. So we're empowering men too.
Yeah. Well, Timothy.
Yeah. Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Araceli.
Thank you. That was lovely, so Barbara.
I'm doing, it looks like a repeat but it's not, never a repeat, exact repeat in these times. I'm doing a series, Urban Tantra, Sacred Sex for the 20th Century, and it will include ecstatic breath work and how to create tantric connections even when you can't be in the same room, how to do sex magic, which you can definitely do socially distanced, and how to take erotic risks, because frankly, everything is going to be an erotic risk as we come out of lockdown. The way, as Sherry Huber says, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. So the way we take an erotic risk is the way we take any kind of risk as we try to reopen our communities. And that will start on, or has started, depending on when this podcast airs,
right,
on March 10th. So you can take the whole series or you can take things, the classes individually. And what I'm hoping, my intention with this series is to help people use an erotic spiritual practice to strengthen their resilience. We're not all one day going to pop out of this pandemic like out of a bad dream or out of a magic spell. It's going to be a process that takes as much resilience to get out of as it took to live within it.
Mm-hmm.
And strengthening your ecstatic resilience muscles will make it not only easier, but a whole lot more fun and joyous. And if people have been feeling kind of dull and like they're living a half life, I totally get it.
Mm-hmm.
This series will give you a way to come out of that dullness and numbness. So join us at one class or the whole series.
Yeah, my understanding is that you're it's a building block. So you're going to be with each class. It gets bigger, better and bigger, better and bigger.
Better and bigger, better and bigger. Yeah, it is a building block. But if you missed a class, because we are recording them so that people in a different time zone can come and watch them later, the Open Center has been super generous about individually letting people buy classes that have passed so that they can take the whole series and not just where they dropped in, if they want to.
That's right. Thank you, Barbara.
Yeah.
Thank you. It is, again, absolutely fabulous to talk to you, Araceli, and you too, Timothy.
Thank you, Barbara. Before we close out, would you have any tips or health advice for us quarantine folks here?
Oh, yes. This is my big one these days. And it's radical acceptance. You've, I'm sure, heard about it in some other classes and courses and books, but radical acceptance means accepting everything or something exactly as it is, and here's the kicker, with no expectation that it will change. Now, everything changes all the time, but radical acceptance means you let go of your death grip on trying to make something other than what it is and just say, hey, if this never, ever changes, if I assume it will always be like this and I can't change it, what else is possible? What else could happen? What would I do instead? And it opens up all sorts of possibilities for the new. And it also relaxes your death grip on an outcome or on a goal. And here's another one that I'm trying to do because it helps day to day. I try to live what I love. I try to do more of the things that I enjoy and less of the things I don't. Now, some people are in situations where the things they don't love are their lives these days. I totally get it. But if you can find something in your life that you actually really love or love doing or love being with, how can you expand doing that just a little more? Or if you're lucky, a lot more. And could you let go of the things you don't love so much and let somebody else who likes them better do them? And before you say, no, I'm stuck, just think about it. Just think about it. And the last one is, I try to live in amazement. I try to find something each day that I'm amazed by. Like, life is wacky, and I like wacky. I'm amazed at how wacky things get. And living in America these days, especially the past 4 years, it got wacky.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also amazed by, like, the infinite kindness and the courage of humanity. People are doing amazing things for other people right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm amazed by how little I know and how much I can learn in a single day. So make a list of what amazes you. That's my last tip.
All righty. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sure.
Wow. Thank you so much, Barbara.